Okay, I'm gonna get started. I think I'm a bit late already. So thank you everyone for coming. The talk today is gonna be mainly about supporting end-to-end buffer compression and how we solve that using frame buffer modifiers. So my assumption going into this was that people here didn't have a ton of graphics experience, in particular 3D. So many of the slides are kind of going to be discussing the problem as sort of a lead up to the solution. And so the solution part should be pretty straightforward and hopefully quick. So a quick bit about me. So if any of you have worked with Intel graphics people before, we used to have an architect, Jesse Barnes, and I'm sort of the replacement Jesse Barnes. So I'm Intel's OTC Linux graphics architect. I work primarily, architect in this context means our driver architect, so both the 3D user space and kernel, and sort of unlike Jesse, I'm more, I treat both equally. Jesse was certainly more in favor of kernel stuff. He paid more attention there. And my first plumbers was 2011. So first time presenting here, but I've been going for quite a while, although I missed the last few. So I've kind of done a lot of stuff. The last 7 years, I've spent working on open source graphics drivers. And 3 years prior to that, I was working on Intel's Larrabee project, which wasn't an open source graphics driver, nor a graphics product, really. I'm an avid buffer modifier. That's a joke. And so as you guys may or may not realize, a lot of companies that do both Windows and Linux drivers, they often have separate teams working on their stacks. And so in our case, the Intel Windows driver for OpenGL and DirectX supported this end-to-end compression, which we'll talk more about in a little bit. And I went to a conference a couple years ago, GDC, and I was talking with some of my counterparts, and they were telling us about all the hurdles they had to go through in order to kind of make Windows not realize what they were doing, the WDDM. And I thought, well, this should be easy in Linux, right? We can control the whole stack, like no problem. And it turned out that was not actually the case. It was a lot of problems.
Oops.
So yeah, and similarly to our Windows counterparts, a lot of the closed source graphics drivers supported this already, and it was kind of a shame that we didn't have support for it on our driver. So I just wanted to give a quick overview here of kind of all the work that went in. So we had three like major collaborators here that some were contracted, others were doing it voluntarily for their own products. But like as you can see, I mean the checks mark where people were contributing from the different companies and in the different parts of the stack. And we'll get into some of these what it meant in more detail. But I think this is pretty impressive. Looking at this, it's hard to imagine that we actually seem to make some progress on it. So after many years, some of the first modifier work was proposed around 2014. We're finally making progress. We have a Mesa release and a kernel release that supports the bits needed to handle compression, specifically, and wide-tiled scan out. And full compression support should be there soon. We're having a little bit of review feedback and churn around some of the protocol work. It's not quite going as fast as I'd like. Oh, and that reminds me, today is the 30th anniversary of the first release of X11, so it was kind of interesting timing. So the question here is, are we making mountains out of molehills? And I think a lot of people might look at the problem of that we're trying to solve with graphics compression and say, well, I don't know that we actually need this. So I'll break it down a little bit for you, at least for our hardware. Each execution unit, which is like the most fundamental block that you can run programmable shaders or any sort of compute jobs on, will use at their current frequencies about a gigabyte of bandwidth per second. So if you just let them run and do their thing for a given application, they'll use that much bandwidth, which means that you can't just add more EUs to make things go faster because you may have already capped your memory bandwidth, your system memory bandwidth. And there's a lot of operations which require a lot of going to memory a lot. Blending, for instance, you need to access different buffers to actually make the blend. Transparency is the same way. Anti-aliasing will sample multiple things. And the problem's not getting any better. I mean, we're getting more effects. Display is doing crazy stuff, as you can see. I mean, almost 2 gigabytes a second, just scanning out pixels. And that's at like kind of our current situation. So as you increase, that's just going to get worse. And yeah, I'll show you a little bit of an example. But we are already memory bandwidth limited in SoCs and integrated graphics. And the way that, of course, Discrete gets around this is they have their own memory right on the card. So here's sort of a outline, and we'll go over each of these in a little more detail. But just generally, this is what happens when you're doing 3D. These are the rough steps of how you get your application that's using OpenGL or Vulkan or, excuse me, whatever, how you get it onto the screen. And each step here represents where we're using memory bandwidth in the system. So to start with, you have an application. It lives on your disk, just like most other applications. And there's a bunch of binary data that exists in the application. Some of these are art that are created by artists. Some of these are like audio files. If you're playing a game, you might have pre-compiled shaders, geometry data, meshes, so on. And that all has to get into memory somehow. So there's this upload. You need to actually take this data from the disk and put it into memory. And that uses memory bandwidth. And that's write memory bandwidth. Texturing is probably one of the largest consumers of memory bandwidth that we have, although it depends on the workload. So on the right, you see a MIP map, and we won't get into MIP maps really, but imagine like a scene where, you know, you have an X-Wing in Star Wars, and it's flying out, and in the distance you see them rebuilding the Death Star, and it looks something like, there we go, pointer, I can get a pointer. Oops, sorry. So it looks something like this, right? I mean, maybe, imagine you're in the distance here, so you can't see that Luke destroyed part of the Death Star. And you have several different MIP levels, and depending on how far your object is from the eye, the hardware will automatically use, it will use a MIP level. So this is defined in GLSpec, how it picks. And so there's several different filtering modes. So nearest is the simplest. If you have kind of a one-to-one mapping or not quite, the hardware will just pick the closest possible sample in the texture and use that. The next one up is bilinear filtering, which will take the four closest samples and blend them in some way. And then you get trilinear filtering, which is basically two bilinear probes, and that will say if you don't exactly land on one MIP level based on your distance from the eye or the camera, it'll take both and it'll blend those. And then you get into like nutso land, which is anisotropic filtering. And for discrete cards, they can kind of afford this, but what you'll probably see in your mobile devices and in your integrated graphics is that this is entirely too expensive to do, mostly. So here's kind of the summary of the multiplier you're looking at for memory bandwidth. So and I'll come back to that in a little bit. But going back to our sort of pipeline of what's using memory bandwidth, so the next step is if you're texturing from something, you're going to do something with it. And so in what you see here, this isn't actually really doing anything useful with it. It's taking a sample from your texture. In fact, Texel Fetch by default doesn't actually do any filtering. And then it will just copy it out to a new buffer. So you have a read from your texture, and you have a write to some other render buffer or whatever. But again, you're consuming memory bandwidth here. So one of the next steps is compositing. You need to display this somehow, and typically you'll have a compositor running that's going to show your windows. And there's a couple ways that compositors can work, and we'll also discuss that a little bit. But in the general case, the compositor is going to have to take the contents of the window that are being drawn and copy it onto the screen. So there's a read operation from what you've drawn and a write operation into what will be presented to the to the eyes looking at the screen. It's like traditional window managers, if any of you are familiar with that, except window managers by default will draw to the front buffer being the thing that you're actively looking at, and compositing will typically draw to a back buffer and composite it onto the main screen. Finally, the display engine, which is what actually gets the pixels out into your eyes. And so the display engine, as you can see, I mean, that's reading from memory. It's all a pipeline. If any of you are familiar with media, it's kind of the same deal. So you've rendered your scene. It was started in 3D. You turned it into 2D. And then display needs to go and scan out all those pixels. And so that's reading a whole lot of memory. And as you can see here, I kind of like drew little pixels that are coming out, and the V blanks and the H blanks. And display is typically just fixed function hardware that's capable of doing this. So it's nothing special, but it is a substantial amount of your overall bandwidth. And so if we kind of sum this up, and I want to go back for 1 second. I guess I forgot to mention that we're just drawing a 64 by 64 Rubik's Cube-like thing with a texture as the source. So I guess one thing I should have made clear, where's my thing? You can certainly draw a Rubik's Cube with, like, as a 3D model, right? You can easily say, okay, I have all these points for my cube and all these different colors, and that would actually be just fine. But again, imagine a scene where, like, you don't want to spend a lot of compute power. You just want to, you know, essentially the way that texturing works is you can draw a rectangle and then have all your pixels be directly sampled from this texture, which is kind of nice if you don't want to do anything too complex. So we're drawing a Rubik's Cube. So if I kind of break out these stages, what you get is drawing your 64 by 64 Rubik's Cube. So this is pretty small and like insignificant in most cases. Just that will be 5.625 megabytes per second of bandwidth. And if you recall, there was all these fancy filtering modes. Now, the anisotropic ones are a little bit fuzzy because the way anisotropy works here is it depends on the angle of the object. So these are all worst case, but like just to hammer this home, a 64 by 64 Rubik's Cube, depending on its orientation, by itself, just displaying that, can use 3.84 gigabytes per second of memory bandwidth, just that. So what's the solution? Or what has up to date been the solutions for this problem? So on the left here is what you just saw. And so I tried to get comparably priced bandwidth or memory modules with the same price and show how the bandwidth is increasing over time. So obviously one solution is, well, we need more bandwidth, let's make more bandwidth. And if you can see on the here, I mean, if you just look at what a discrete card can do with HBM versus what dual channel DDR can do, it's a factor of 10 there. And HBM2 is like twice as fast depending on how many you stack. So that's increasing much faster. But yeah, I'll get to the problems later. Another solution is hardware composition. So this is one that the community's been working on for a very long time. So if you recall, there was this compositing step that had to read from one buffer and write it into another buffer, and that's super expensive, potentially. And a lot of hardware will support directly scanning out to what's called sometimes overlay planes or universal planes or whatever. And that'll save you a bunch of bandwidth. Problems later, I promise. That'll save you a bunch of bandwidth. So if you kind of just take out the one composite step, well, you're down by 33% just by doing that. So one of the other solutions, and this has been sort of an industry standard, is texture compression. I'll explain a little bit how this works, but let me bring up the data here. So texture compression is a way of offline compressing your texture to be smaller, and some of them are lossless and some of them are lossy. In this case, I picked a fairly easy one to show you guys. So this is DXT1 compression, which gets lossless or lossily 8:1 compression. And essentially, you have these pixel blocks that are represented down here. Everything is converted to 565 color space from 888, and you get two derived colors, and then the block is able to reference the different colors. So if you look at this weird too, that's because in the Rubik's Cube you have a little gap here. It's hard for me to center in on that. And then you get the black lines. Hopefully it's pretty obvious what's going on there. And if you guys are curious to try and run it, here's the command line I used. You have to make your own cube.png. But you get 8:1 compression, and what's nice is in both the texture upload and then later when you're fetching the texture, that's just free. Now, I will get into the problems in a little bit. So increasing the bandwidth is not really feasible. I mean, it's nice, and you kind of, if it's there, you'll take it, right? But not every platform you're working on is just gonna have all the bandwidth you want. If you're, you know, making a new design, you might need to have different layout for your board. Things might need to be fabricated on a different process. It's just, and power. I mean, typically, as the processes get better, the power goes down, but it's not always the case. So I guess I'll take it, right? Like, you give me more bandwidth, great. We'll do what we can with that. But trust me when I say game developers will use all the bandwidth you give them. More planes is kind of a similar sort of situation. You get what you get, and we can try and make do with whatever we get, and that's cool. But not all hardware has overlay planes. Not all hardware has a relevant number of overlay planes. I hear from people that certain ARM socks have like hundreds of overlay planes, and I talked to my display architect, hardware architect, and I said, like, what's the deal here? Like, you're telling me that we get four, and maybe we get six in the future, and the ARM guys have hundreds, and he's like, no, they don't. So, I don't know. You guys can tell me, maybe. Not true. Well, someone claimed they have hundreds.
At least 10 of them.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, five.
Five, all right, 16. Well. So in any case, like maybe you get 16, but there's still a trade-off because you're trading gates to support those 16 overlay planes for something else you might be able to do.
Oh,
they're asymmetric in some way, yeah. So our planes are asymmetric too, although that's going away. So great, it doesn't really scale. I mean, maybe in some devices it does. If you're in a closed system and you're using Android and you know, for instance, I'm only ever gonna have four overlay planes, then sure. Like, we can kind of lock ourselves into this. But if you wanna talk about any sort of desktop or general purpose scenario where you wanna put each window into an overlay plane, well, you know, okay, so after you open four windows, now you start paying the cost. And how do you know which window is the one that's using all the memory bandwidth? I mean, you start getting into these protocol nightmares of trying to swap and make the highest memory bandwidth consumer use the overlay plane. Okay.
So scans. So it doesn't have to be a contiguous framework for the entire visible area. You can have multiples and you can fake.
Yeah, that's.
Four planes.
I've heard this word fake before. So yeah, okay. And in any case, until. Unless you can have like arbitrarily many planes, it doesn't solve the general case. Now, again, maybe a lot of people don't care about the general case, and that's fair. So texture compression, you're kind of limited by the hardware. The hardware has to support it. I don't know if this shows up pretty well. So DXT1 compression is not state of the art at all, but it doesn't look good. I mean, I don't know why the NVIDIA tools did such a poor job. That should have been a pretty easy to compress thing, but that's what you get. Like, if you were making a game and you were making your own assets and you use the NVIDIA tools and you're like, I want 8:1 compression, that is what you get, which is not good. And really fundamentally, what we're missing here is you're missing out on several parts of your display path here that don't benefit from texture compression. Because again, you're texturing from this thing, doing something with it, and then writing it out to a render buffer to be displayed later. Now, I guess potentially you could write it out in a compressed format that's an industry standard offline compression format, and if you're display hardware understood it, that would work. But lossless compression is sort of there to solve that. And if you think about it, in the other case, you won't get predictable results because you're compressing to potentially a lossy format. And just for fun, I wanted to show you guys what it looked like if you just scaled this thing down by 8. So this was the original versus DXT, and then this is what it looked like if you just shrunk it by a factor of 8 and then blew it back up. So I'm not too impressed with the XT1, but I guess, again, people don't really use it anymore. So cool. This does some useful stuff, actually significant bandwidth savings, but we still have some lacking areas where we can, get some savings. So we're going to introduce here now end-to-end lossless compression, which is really what this is talking about. So basically, this is supplementary to the other techniques we've already talked about. In some cases, sometimes you can get limited. And it one thing that people ask me to point out, because it's a common cause of confusion, and I will get into this in more detail, it doesn't actually reduce the size of anything. So in fact, everything actually gets slightly bigger, but you have to access less parts of it, is one good way of putting it. And the way that this works really is just as long as all the hardware blocks are able to understand this compression format, you can potentially decode into some surface, texture from some surface, you know, anything you want, and behind the scenes the compression is natively handled for you. So some of the pros to that is you're getting lossless compression, which means from an API perspective, you can expect conformant results and no issues. And the other big nice thing is that applications and tools don't actually need to do anything. So if you wanted to use DXT1 compression again, either your game engine, SDK, whatever, needs to compress the texture, and this needs to happen offline. And my understanding is this is actually a fairly costly time-wise process for these bigger games, because they have tons of assets, and it takes forever to compress. And while I'm not saying get rid of texture compression, this one you just get for free. So the other points here, you get all the benefits end-to-end. And one thing that's interesting, and I'll show some numbers at the end here, is if you're not actually texturing, like this by itself, so if you're not texturing, obviously texture compression doesn't help you at all. And this gets you like ridiculous improvements on cases where you don't texture. The cons, of course, it's relatively low compression. So I did the best I could to research this. If you guys know hardware, some of the competitive hardware to Intel, and I'm wrong, let me know. But currently on Intel, the max compression ratio we can get is a 2-to-1 compression ratio. It seemed to me like 4-to-1 seems to be about the industry standard. NVIDIA makes some claims about 8-to-1, and I don't want to tell them their claims are wrong, but I've seen those claims. But really the fundamental problem with this is not every image will be compressible. So we have some internal benchmarks, for instance, which will write random data, and you try and compress random, and you're going to end up with nothing compressible. And so, like I said earlier, there's a size increase to do this. And so you can actually, in the pathological case, you can actually hurt performance doing this. And you're limited by the hardware, right? So if you write your application and you run it on one system, maybe you'll get lossless compression and things will be great, and then you run it on another system and you don't get it. And things won't be as good. And then as the developer, you have to go and figure out, well, these platforms have the same memory. I don't understand why I'm getting less bandwidth on one. But it seems like the industry is sort of heading towards this. At least as far as I can tell, many people have these kinds of things. So kind of summarizing what we just talked about here, there's several opportunities for where you can actually save bandwidth. So if you recall, these textures may or may not be compressed. You do your texture upload. When you actually sample from a texture, that's when the hardware will turn this into the compressed format. And so it'll generate this opaque data that used to be pixel data and some ancillary data, which we call aux data. And from there on, you can kind of speak in this compression format. So when you do your frame buffer write, you're actually writing it in the compressed format. When the compositor samples from it, unless it's directly scanning out, you talk in the compressed format. And finally, when the display reads it, it says, hey, I know how to deal with this compressed format, so I'm going to decompress it for you on the fly. These three places, all you get whatever your texture or whatever your lossless compression ratio is. And on average, I've been told we get about 1.6 to 1, but you'll see why I don't think that's true. So let's see, how am I doing on time? Yeah, okay. So I was kind of curious, like I wanted to kind of figure out how you can make this work. So I made a little dumb example of how you can achieve 2-to-1 texture compression. I don't actually know how our hardware works. They don't tell us. They say driver developers don't need to know. But just to kind of give you some understanding of how you can achieve it. So in my case, we have, so this does represent our hardware. We have this extra data, and two bits per cache line represent two cache lines in the main surface. So if you think of all of these things as pixels, and here's what one cache line worth of pixels look like in our tiled format, you are able to represent 32K worth of pixel data with one cache line. And what you can do, and what I did in my case, is you have some encoding scheme, and for instance, one-to-one says, okay, this isn't compressed. If you need to read from it, you need to read both cache lines, invalid. You have a clear color, so what happens often in graphics applications is you'll set your surface to just a color. There's a GL clear operation, and it'll set it to a given color. And what almost all hardware does is it says, I'm not gonna actually write any of those pixels. I'm gonna say that thing, that surface is the clear color, and the clear color is green. So that would be stored here, and that has been stored here historically. And then you'll have this other encoding which says, hey, maybe I have this like other situation going on here. And so in my case, I just picked a little, there's a little index here, and it tells you, okay, for each of the pixels, and there should be, you know, however many, 16, 32 pixels, I guess. 4 divided by 16. Yeah, for each of the pixels, you know, it's one of these colors. So if you have two adjacent cache lines with less than or equal to 15 colors, you will get compression. Hopefully that was fairly clear. What's sort of interesting is even simple run length encoding on a thing like that Rubik's Cube will get you, I did a quick test and it got me 3-to-1 compression. So it can be pretty easy to get 2-to-1 at least. So cool, with all that, we're actually making a difference here. Like the frame buffer write part, you know, that was the part where after you've sampled your texture and you're writing it out into something you want to display, you save 2x there, and you save 2x on the compositing step, and you save 2x on scanout. So that's significant, 33% savings just by introducing this thing that applications can't see. And so if you kind of add things up, you actually see that from our, from the original problem here, you're ending up with quite a bit of savings if you can kind of get away with using anything, or everything rather. So before I go on to the actual solution now, that was all the problem. Are there any questions? Okay, your loss. So what were the challenges? I came onto this in right around this time last year, and like I said, we were seeing competition do this, and I was really annoyed that we weren't getting it done in Linux. We had a few like disjoint efforts to make it work, internal and external both. And so what kind of cropped up as the biggest problems are everything today, or up until recently, considers anything you want to display as just pixel data. This is true of pretty much all display server protocol that I've ever seen. And the problem that you have with that is no longer is it the case that this is just pixel data. In fact, in my dumb example, it's not, well, I guess there is color information in there, but it's not pixel data at all. It's just a lookup table with the actual lookup values. So basically the entire stack needs to be made aware that no longer am I just passing around, okay, a buffer with maybe a format. And in the X world, not even really a format. When I say format, I mean like RGB8. And there's another buffer, right? Like, so you have your thing that used to be pixel data and is now compressed data, and you have that little cache line that I showed that's actually showing you what that all means. That needs to be stashed somewhere, and in an ideal world, that's not just hidden, like you actually pass it along. So everything needed to be made aware of this. Like, you know, anytime an application wants to draw through DRI protocol, it basically either gets a buffer from X, depending on which protocol, or allocates its own buffer, but it needs to share those buffers, and when it passes it along, again, it has to say, oh, okay, by the way, it might not actually just be pixels, and so you need to figure out what to do with it, potentially. So one of the other problems that kind of came up, and this kind of applies to what you were saying, is it's not always symmetric. So in our hardware currently, for instance, one of our pipes doesn't support compression. So there's like cases where maybe one of your displays will get switched underneath as to which pipe's running, and now you need to say, okay, I was using compression, and now I can no longer use compression. So this was all kind of the trouble we had getting there. And up until I came around, there were, well, three kind of proposed solutions. The first one was my proposal when I started making this presentation. The first thing I asked is, well, we already have these 4cc formats that represent what the actual pixel data is. Why don't we just jam some modifier in there to say, oh, it's actually compressed, or oh, maybe it's something else. And in fact, V4L does this to some degree. I mean, they have, it's fairly limited, but if you go and look at that header file, they have like vendor compressed formats, and I don't actually know what they do or how it works, but I'm guessing that works for them. On our side, there was a lot of concern about the number of modifiers that would eventually be needed, and so the idea of like encoding this into 4cc formats and you know combinatorially blowing out the number of defines there was I guess not ideal, but nobody ever really proposed this as far as I know, and I'm not sure why. The next proposal was doing an Intel specific ERM plane property, so you would be able to query the plane and you would be able to set the plane and turn on compression or turn off compression. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with this. And again, this predates me coming onto the scene, but it was decided that a lot of drivers have this problem, and so let's just solve it for everybody instead of doing an Intel-specific thing. And one of the other proposals was doing something with DMA buff metadata, so when you get a DMA buff, you can attach your compression status to it and go along with that. So in the end, we chose modifiers. They've been there for a while. I put a picture there of Rob Clark's original commit. It was nice because we already had support for it. It was already in our API to some degree, and it just meant sort of extending what modifiers we needed to be able to say, this pixel data is no longer pixel data, it's actually compressed data, and maybe there's more planes needed. Similarly, at the same time, we actually support different memory layouts, tiling formats, and so we were able to add those as well. The problem with this, and this exists in all of the three proposals, is you do need protocol at some level, again, like I was describing, to be aware of that. And one of the other issues is the compression modifier, how do I say it? It sort of goes against what the modifier's original intent was, which was, it's describing the layout of the pixels. So for instance, maybe your pixel layout is just linear, or for you guys this way. And maybe you have a modifier that says, oh, actually, you know, we'll do one block at a time, and it's a different layout. And actually, this modifier is kind of being abused in the sense that it's not pixel data at all. And also, you have to look at this other place to figure out what it is. But nevertheless, we chose modifiers, and we had a lot of work to do. And so we're kind of going to step through that a bit. So generally, the way that this works from end-to-end perspective is you have some sort of KMS client. Typically, for us, this means a compositor. And that thing will basically make all of the sync APIs agree on it'll negotiate what all the sync APIs can do. So if you look here, there were several areas we needed to add. So the first one is what I call blobifiers, and that was a blob property which reports back what modifiers are supported for the different formats. So if you go back here, I have this little, where'd it go? I have this little guy, and that's getting the modifiers that work for the given formats. We had to add EGL extensions, so EGL is sort of like a binding. You can think of it as like a Windows system binding, or if you're familiar with GLX, it's kind of like the equivalent of GLX without X. We needed to add ways for people to utilize EGL with modifiers. So for instance, if you want to actually have a buffer and import it into EGL, it needs to be aware of these modifiers. And similarly, you needed to be able to figure out for given formats that you want to render to what modifiers you can use. So this was sort of the first step. You know, we have some Vulkan work that's in progress, but you can imagine all of these sync APIs. I mean, you could have, you know, we have VAPI, LibVA, video acceleration, decode, and encode. And potentially that could also export modifiers. It can say, hey, I can decode NV12 into the surface, and oh yeah, it'll be compressed. And then your compositor would need to take that into account too. So with that, take that and shove it down your protocol pipe. the DRI client, which is the actual application we're talking about, will acquire the list of modifiers that it should use. Now, it could potentially ignore these things. And I mean, I'm not a display server protocol expert, so I won't spend too much time here. But this is basically what we needed to add in order to get this working. So there was DRI 3.1 protocol, it needed to be revved, and we needed to add Wayland protocol. And that's all in flight currently. So once your DRI client has that data, you want to create a buffer that you want to display it eventually. And you have two ways of doing that currently, either GBM or EGL. At some point, Vulkan WSI is also going to be an option. And you create your buffer with the modifiers using, where'd it go? So the EGL will do it implicitly, and the GBM, you actually will call out the specific modifiers that you want to add. But at the end of the day, you end up with a buffer object, BO, that you can actually display at some point. And so here's what we needed to do that. All the plumbing for EGL needed to be added. GBM functions were created. DRI image is like this internal, well, it's not actually internal, but it's some abstraction for images that work with direct rendering. So, to go back to the first slide here, we've just had several companies working on all of this at the same time. And here's the end-to-end story that we were just talking about. So, and I'll put the slides up somewhere later, and you guys can read it. But essentially, you end up with some client that wants to display something, and it needs to be made aware of what modifiers it should use. And to most part, unless you're using GBM, it has no idea that any of this is actually going on. It's all hidden behind Display Server Protocol and the existing WinSys layers in Mesa. So there's a few options then in order to actually display it. I didn't want these stepped out, so hang on. So we kind of discussed before what compositing is and how software would composite to it. So again, one of the extensions that we had to work to get is a way of taking your buffer and importing it into EGL with modifiers. So the compositor would say, okay, DRI client, give me your buffer that you want me to display, tell me what the modifiers are, and then I can go and turn that into an EGL image, which I can sample from and actually use and composite in my scene. There was a lot of work required. I don't know why I wrote much work required. So EGL is a Kronos-based spec, and we needed to actually go in there and get extension work done, and there were several revs and several revs of the Mesa patches. It took a while. And the other option is directly scanning out, so like we talked about before. And all that required, so that was the one benefit of using modifiers, is that AddFB2 already supported this. So what the compositor would do at that point is it would get the buffer object from the client, and it would do an AddFB2 on it and say, okay, it has these modifiers, and then behind the scenes we're able to say, it's compressed, and our display needs to decompress it. And so here's kind of a picture of what we just described. So the top is the compositor is sampling from the buffer object and writing it into its one plane, and in the bottom it's sort of using per plane or all the overlays to display stuff. So you get a DRM frame buffer using AddFB2 from your DMA buff. That was the hardware compositing method, and there was the EGL image import. So when I left 2 days ago from, or 3 days ago, we had our benchmark data kind of all working, but we didn't yet have all the bits for display server. We didn't have everything building and running properly. So when I left, I was like, okay, I'm going to give this talk, and I'm going to explain to these people why memory bandwidth is so valuable in the system and how lossless compression is going to save us. And to cut to the chase, if you look at the fourth row there, T-Rex is a pretty standard benchmark, one of the ones that we're targeting, and we got 3% improvement. So it's not that good. But if you look at the top two, Let's go in order real quick. So what's interesting about both KMS Cube and GLX gears is they don't texture from anything. So like we discussed before, there's all these points in the pipeline where you can potentially require a lot of memory bandwidth and end up getting blocked waiting for more memory bandwidth. And so since these things don't texture from anything, they hit really heavily on only those paths that we said we can reduce. And so what's interesting is, if you recall, I said we can potentially get 2-to-1 compression ratio, and what you see exactly with KMS Cube is, I should mention the units here. I guess the KMS Cube, you can measure memory bandwidth on Intel systems through perf, and because KMS Cube is using KMS page flips, you're stuck at 60 FPS. It'll always go to the native refresh rate. So the easiest way to measure the improvement was bandwidth. And so if you recall, I said, well, our hardware supports 2-to-1 compression, and it's a very compressible image. And so as you see, like we actually got 2x. So it turned out it did exactly what it was supposed to do. And similarly with GLX gears, it doesn't sample, flat colors, flat shaded everywhere. I don't know how we got more than 2.2x, but we did. And then, so T-Rex, I guess the takeaways here, and hopefully you can kind of guess based on everything leading up to now, some of the theories you might have as to why T-Rex didn't improve is, well, maybe it wasn't actually memory bandwidth limited to begin with. I don't know. Problem elsewhere, right? Or maybe the render buffers that it was rendering to aren't actually very compressible with the given format. So I guess the takeaway for me there is I'm a little disappointed. I was expecting 10 to 15% in that area, and we didn't get it, and I'm not sure why. So we're gonna have to go back and look at it a bit. So just to summarize a little bit. Memory bandwidth requirements, again, remember anisotropic 16x, like ridiculous off the charts, be careful. Don't assume that texture compression is the end of this, right? Like there's other parts in your pipeline that you need to worry about when you're using memory bandwidth. And in fact, those are more concerning to developers because they have so little control or insight into it. Typically, it's just what the hardware does. Modifiers modify the, I put modify in quotes. Modifiers explain the layout of the pixel data, and in the compression case, that was a little bit muddied. Lossless compression can actually increase size, and it's all about, you know, when you do those cache line fetches, fetching one cache line instead of both, but the actual size of the overall surface is bigger, and many GPUs today support it transparently. Hardware compositing's cool. We want more of it. So again, getting features like this can be a multi-year effort. It took us, once I started kind of driving this, it took about a year. We're not quite finished yet. For those of you that need to do this sort of end-to-end stuff, be prepared for it to take a while. And I think that's something as a community we really need to improve because, like I said, closed source competition is doing this in whatever way they want to. Windows and Apple are doing this, and Linux as a whole ends up looking bad as a result. So one other thing I wanted to bring up on this slide. If you're familiar with Optane or these forms of non-volatile memory that are memory, you run into a little bit of a problem that we're going to have to try and solve in the near future. So you can imagine Intel's going to ship an Optane system at some point, or whatever I don't remember the name of some of the competing technologies, but the latency and bandwidth for Optane is pretty bad. So I'm assuming if you're using graphics, you'll always have to have some other memory that's faster, DRAM, or maybe something else that the graphics can actually use. And so you're gonna run into the scenario where even in integrated, and I assume if SoCs did something similar, you're gonna have to actually start transitioning your GPU your GPU data from Optane or your non-volatile memory to DRAM. And so one of the problems that we're kind of currently looking into, if people want to talk to me about it, that'd be great, is how do you represent a buffer that needs to be in one of those two memory domains? So for instance, let's say you have a buffer that you definitely know needs to be displayed. How do you say, okay, it needs to go in the fast memory? Or how do you say it should never move back to the slow memory? So a few thank yous here. I mean, I wanted to call out some of the people. Well, so the first two helped a great deal, both in implementation and actually looked at my presentation. So hopefully it's factually accurate, and you can blame them if it's not. And the gold level there people are people who worked on the patches quite a bit. And then we got a lot of review, and I wanted to call them out. There was definitely more people from some of the other communities that I wasn't expecting to even bother looking at this stuff. And I'm grateful that they did. I think in the end, we ended up with something that should serve us for several years before we need to do something different at FB3, for instance. And so with that, I'll leave it up to you guys if you have any questions. I don't know if I ran over or under or whatever, but it doesn't seem like anybody's trying to get in the room. And don't ask me about EGL streams. What's next?
Is there something? What do you think?
I want to land the protocol bits. One of the things that I see as sort of a problem that we have, and I assume others do as well outside of the Android domain, is we don't have a lot of display server expertise. So when we want to go in and figure out how to plumb this through in X, like, we don't have anybody who can do it. And it's difficult to find those resources. So I think, yeah, for me, next is just making sure that the rest of those protocol bits get landed. We have, like I said, I think figuring out how to kind of mark domains, memory domains, for your buffers is something we really need to figure out. I am not aware of any product that's shipping with Optane and Intel graphics, but I can only imagine there's going to be one. And they're going to expect Linux to just work on it. And that's actually a pretty big shift of how we've been doing things in integrated graphics, where it's a UMA system and everything is, you know, equally slow or equally fast. So, yeah, for me, maybe. I mean, some of the proposals that have been tossed around is transparent migration between the two domains, and user space doesn't even know about it. I don't actually have much of an opinion, as long as whatever opinion people decide on works. Some of the other things that I think we're going to see will suit modifiers quite well. I expect, for instance, I can go back. I expect, for instance, it's in my dumb example. So I expect, for instance, like, the next sensible thing to do is, okay, we know how this compression works. What about the clear color? So one of the things I can very much foresee coming is, oh, you've cleared a surface to red, and you've drawn over some part of it, and make Display Engine aware of the fact that it was clear. But I think modifiers should suit that very well. The modifiers don't?
So producer might have a list of compression formats that support. It doesn't mean the plane is going to support all of them.
Yeah.
The same. Plus, depending on how the board gets laid out, certain combinations might be more common than others. So we need a place where we can do negotiation.
Some sort of negotiation. Yeah, so some amount of this is going to be baked into the protocol. At least for DRI-3, which maybe you don't care about. But yeah, this was one of the, I think that problem itself was one of the original reasons why modifiers sort of stalled, because these complexities came up and it became, how do we solve this? And I think in the end, sort of my goal was just get something working, and if we need to make it better later, we can. Yeah, okay. So if you guys didn't hear and you care, it wasn't in 4CC because 4CC was considered standard. So I guess V4L sort of just like forked it. I mean, they have their own V4L 4CC stuff. But
one that's in the kernel, I think, is considered to be the version.
Yes.
What's the story of sharing this with video? Or like being able to find that it also includes
Well, when you say story, you mean like, will it work? Huh? I don't know. I mean, I don't work much on the media side, but there's nothing that would prevent it from working if you had a media engine that was capable of doing compression. So if you you know, decoded into a texture and it was compressed, and the texture sampler understood that compression format, in theory, all the modifier work that we have in place should support this through EGL image importing. But is the question, is anybody working on this from the media side? So for Intel, our hardware doesn't support it. Our hardware can't decode into any sort of compressed format. Now, a better question might be to ask why we don't have NV12 scanout, and then I'll let you address that. But I think, like I said, I was pretty disappointed T-Rex didn't do better than it did. I was like really hoping to come out here and be like, 15%, man, like, we did it, and we didn't. So, okay, any other questions? No, all right, thank you, everybody.